today's Taisho will be on case 8 in the Blue Rock Collection, the Hikigan Roku. Case 8 is entitled Suigan's Eyebrows. Engo's introduction: the enlightened person enjoys perfect freedom in active life. He is like a dragon supported by deep waters, or like a tiger that commands its mountain retreat. The person who is not enlightened drifts about in the affairs of the world. He is like a ram that gets its horns caught in a fence, or like a man who waits for a hare to run against a tree stump and stun itself. The enlightened person's words are sometimes like a lion crouched to spring, sometimes like the Diamond King's treasure sword. Sometimes their effort is to shut the mouths of the world-famed ones. Sometimes it is as if they simply follow the waves coming one after another. When the enlightened person greets others who are enlightened, then friend meets friend. He values them, and they encourage each other. When he meets those who are adrift in the world, then the teacher meets student. His way of dealing with such people is far-sighted. He stands firm before them like a 1,000-foot cliff. Therefore, it is said that the way of the Absolute is manifest everywhere. It has no fixed rules and regulations. The teacher sometimes makes a blade of grass stand for the golden-faced Buddha, 16 feet high, and sometimes makes the golden-faced Buddha, 16 feet high, stand for a blade of grass. Tell me, on what principle is all of this based? Do you understand? See the following. Main subject: Suigan, at the end of the summer session, spoke to the assembly and said, "During the summer session, I have talked to you a great deal. Now look, has Suigan any eyebrows?" Hofuku said, "He who commits theft has a guilty conscience." Chokei said, "They have grown." Umon said, "Kan." Secho's verse, Suigan's words, unanswerable in thousands of years. Umon's kan, losing his money, committing a crime, dotard Hofuku. Was he nimble, or did he mumble? Long-tongued Suigan, definitely a thief. Flawless is the jewel. Who can appreciate the priceless? Chokei knew well, he said, "They have grown." So this is the fourth day of our January 2019 Sesshin, and I want to thank everybody for being here, and also for doing such a wonderful job in the Zendo this morning. You know, we're so lucky to have all of these forces come together to make this practice possible. You know, Murray Grove is really like perfect place for us. You know, it's not too expensive. When I first came here, I was looking for a place to have a sesshin. When I first started teaching in New Jersey, I was looking for a place to have sesshin, and there's very little in New Jersey that is appropriate. And there are some places in New York State, some of them are just astronomically expensive. There's a nun who holds sesshin in an old motel that she's converted, and it was rentable, but I don't know, it just didn't work for me. So, you know, this place is just perfect for us, and it's very difficult to get away from, you know, your work and be here, or your school. It takes a lot of maneuvering to make this possible. You know, everybody wants your time and energy. And as I said on day one of sesshin, you know, when the boss is looking for the perfect worker, he would like to find somebody who will work 70 hours a week instead of 40 and not ask for any extra pay, right? And so if you say to your boss, I'm working more and more, basically, even if the boss is a nice guy, he'll be very happy. There's a temptation for the boss just to be happy if you do a lot of work. But it's very important for all of us to make time for an event like this, right? To do what we can. It's not always possible. There are things that just keep tugging at us and won't let us go. So when it is possible to come here and do this, it's so precious. It's so precious. And we have this wonderful place, and we have, basically a wonderful community of people who are dedicated to waking up. And that's very unusual. I was just reading something about, New Jersey politics and how basically under the surface, there's a lot of corruption and people are scuffling for power. I was reading that Governor Murphy wants to do a lot of things. He wants to raise the minimum wage. He wants to legalize marijuana. And he's being stymied by members of his own political party. And the reason is that the head of the Democratic Party in New Jersey wanted to be governor instead of Murphy. And so he's determined to see egg all over Murphy's face, And this stuff goes on everywhere, You don't have to look far to see this kind of ridiculous pettiness. So when you meet people like the members of our community, our Sangha, who are really, serious about waking up, such people are so precious. In the sutras it says that Buddhas are very rare. They say the Buddha is rare like the Udambara flower. And an Udambara flower flowers every 5,000 years. So not often. And Buddhas are even more rare than that. They come along once every kalpa or so. So it's really precious to meet a person who is on the way. And all the people in this room are dedicated to waking up, and that's just really extraordinary and quite wonderful company. And we're all willing to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and rush to the Zendo and sit wholeheartedly. That's my idea of heaven. That's heaven. And everybody is here doing this, and it's wonderful. So it does take a little bit of... It takes a lot of courage. I think I mentioned on day one. It takes a lot of courage just to come here and be here. This is a koan about a teacher named Suigan, and in Chinese then there was what was called an ango, in Japanese. It's a period of training. It was usually like 3 months. It was like a season. And it would start formally, and there'd be a season of practice and punctuated by sesshins. And then it would end, and then there'd be a little break, and it'd be like a semester, basically, So it would be like the semester of training. And actually, Buddhism in China was organized very much like a public education system. In China, there was a system of public temples. And if you had a license to be a monk or a nun, you could go anywhere in China and practice Zen. Zen wasn't the only sect in China, but it was definitely the major sect. And all you, basically a lot of young people would practice at different Zen centers, you know. And they would go from this center to this center to this center. And, you know, it was like join the Navy and see the world, right? You know, if you became a member of the Sangha, you could travel all over China. And this was true even in the 20th century and 19th century. There have been a number of Chan monks who actually went into Tibet and studied there for a while, and vice versa. So there was this rich culture of practice, and you know, you would just show up, present your license, and if you were a person in good standing, you'd be assigned a room, and it was like, you know, be up at 5, be in the Zendo by 5, you know, and you'd go into the Zendo and meet new people. So it was a wonderful system for producing enlightenment. You know from some of the earlier koans that Master Joshu, you know, when he was 80 years old, he was supposed to, his beloved teacher Nanchuan, Nansen, died. And everybody was expecting Zhaozhou to, you know, take over the temple. Instead, Zhaozhou, you know, did the hippie thing. You know, he got his basket, his backpack, basically, they were like a basket, put it on his back, and he started going to different temples and meeting different masters. And many of the koans recount his conversations. So anyway, in this koan, Suigan is a teaching at this temple, and it's the end of the teaching period, the end of the semester, basically. And he spoke to the assembly, and he said, "During the summer semester, I have talked to you a great deal. Now look, has Suigan any eyebrows?" And basically, he's been, you know, giving Taisho every day and for the summer, and he asks if he has any eyebrows or not. And in Buddhist, Chinese Buddhist folk religion, if you said something negative about the Dharma or something harmful to people's progress towards enlightenment, your eyebrows were supposed to fall out. So if you happen to meet any Zen teachers who have no eyebrows, look out. Don't listen to them, whatever you do. So anyway, he says, "Do I still have any eyebrows?" And his colleagues, his friends, who are also deeply awake, all have something to say, right? So Hofuku says, Suigan says, "Do I have any eyebrows?" And Hofuku says, "Oh my gosh, you know, you've just committed a crime and you have a guilty conscience, right?" Choke said, "They've grown." Umon said, "Kan." So each of the masters has a different response, has his own response, see. So, you know, it's important to understand that, you know, Suigan's eyebrows is really, about, in a way, how we often look to others for ratification, right? So basically, you know, Suigan has been doing something wholeheartedly. And at the end of his teaching, as his semester, he says, you know, "So how am I doing?" Right? And that's a natural thing to do, right? "How am I doing?" "Not bad, eh?" You know, and he wants people to go, "Great, you know, excellent, you know." And that's a normal human thing. We all want approbation. We all want approval. But, you know, you have to beware of that reflex, right? You know, we're social beings, so we definitely want approval. And this is how we became human beings to begin with. You know, human beings are made, not born, actually. You know, if you think about it, you know, we learn how to be human beings. And, you know, We learn how to eat. We learn how to go to the bathroom and when and where to go to the bathroom. We learn, you know, how to interact with others. All those things are learned. They're not hardwired. And in order to learn those things, we look to others for approval, right? So, you know, if you, you know, it, I don't know how it was at your house, but, you know, basically my parents had a philosophy of that their kids should have healthy appetites, right? So, you know, basically when we were given a plate full of food, you know, we were supposed to eat it all. And you know, you could show your parents, you say, look, Mom, I ate it all. And my mother would have a beaming face like, good boy, you know, you ate all your food, you know. And, you know, it felt good to get mother's approval. Yes, you know, I ate every last bite, you know. And what a good boy. That felt so good, right? You know, or if my mother said, clean up your room, and I would, you know, put your toys away, and you say, oh, I don't want to put my toys away, you know, you're a bad boy, you're being a bad boy, you know, and then, you know, I eventually, you know, you're not leaving this room till you put your toys away, you know, and so, and so finally you put your toys away, and you realize, oh, this isn't so bad, you know, and you put your toys away, and then, look, Mom, I put my toys away, every last toy. You know, she says, oh, you're such a good boy. You know, oh, that felt so good, right? I mean, I have to say, as you can tell, I loved my mother. And I until she died, I used to talk to her almost every week without fail on the phone. And I still would say, hey, Mom, you'll never guess, you know. I just published an article. She goes, oh, you're so smart. My son is so smart. It's like, ah, thank you, Mom. You know, this actually happened. My mother lived. She retired in Williamsburg, Virginia, which I consider to be one of the more boring places on earth. But she, for some reason, coming from New York, it just seemed like paradise to her. Quiet and. So anyway, she had access. She was a state of Virginia employee, and she had access to the gym at the university there, William & Mary. And this actually happened. It was like she was in the sauna, and she heard two people come in, and actually they're professors. I know. And it was like, you know, the universe just did such a good thing, you know. It said, my mother came, this really happened. It sounds like a story, but it's not. And when I heard it, I just thought, that is amazing. You know, I could have staged it, right? But my mother was in the sauna, and she said, she called me and said, you won't believe what happened. I was in the sauna. And she said, this two women came in, and one woman said, have you read Kurt Spellmeyer's book? It was like, oh my God! And my mother, I said, well, did you tell him you were my mother? And she said, oh no. You know? But she just lit like, oh, you know, wow, you know. And it was like, thank you, universe, you know. So, boy, have I been a good boy. You know, I put my toys away, I've eaten everything on my plate, and now, I've even written this book, and my mother has heard me praised, you know. So that was like a good day. It was a good day for the mother-son relationship. And so, you know, basically, that's so good, right? But, you know, that can also be a trap. You know, it's also can be a trap, right? Because, you know, basically, you can't let that run your life, right? You have to be very careful not to get trapped by your hunger for the praise of others. And it's definitely the case that can be a terrible trap. You know, just to get back to, you know, my mother, you know, I was actually in high school, I'm not boasting, but I worked really hard in math. and in the sciences. And I was one of a real nerd, so I would like come home and study. And I was always hitting the books, and I was very grade conscious. I was really a grade grinder, you know. I did really well in the sciences. And my mother, she was determined that I would become a doctor. You know, and she even bought me it's so ridiculous, but she bought me a chemistry set and a microscope. She actually paid serious money so I would have a microscope, and I would somehow look through this microscope and think, yes, you know, I've got to solve the problem of, you know, I've got to find a cure for disease, you know. And you know, I was more interested in like poetry and stuff, right? And that I'm so sorry she spent that money on that microscope, because I hardly ever used it, right? It was like, oh, thank you, Mother. This is fascinating. You know, I can't wait to look at cell structures, you know. And my heart was far from that, right? I wanted to read poetry, and not, I loved to just sit and read on my bed all day, and science fiction, I just loved, you know. So my mother kept trying to get me to go into medicine, and all I can say is I'm so glad I didn't listen to her, you know, because I'm sure medicine is a wonderful field, but I'm just so glad I wasted my time reading poetry, you know, because it's where I had to do it, you know, I had to do it, I'm very glad I had the strength to do that, you know. I was reading about this poet, a French poet in the 19th century, and he was famous for he's famous for hanging out at cafes, not having a job, basically living off his father, and writing poetry. You know, so anybody would think this guy. I think this was his name is Mallarmé, you know, I think. And, you know, this guy, he was a total bum, right? A total sponge, a bum, you know, a moocher. And he wrote the greatest French poetry in the 19th century. And I was reading this critic who said, and it's so true, he said, you know, Mallarmé was a person of incredible strength in order to live such a weak and wasteful life, you know. And he's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. You know, if Mallarmé had been a weaker person, his dad was like a doctor or a lawyer. He would have gone to, you know, and I'm not criticizing. I mean, I just can't, you know, just before the session, I had to have my, you know, every 5 years, my colonoscopy, right? You know, it's like, and my doctor is a wonderful man, and I'm so glad he's around, you know. So, basically, doctors, I love them, and I have some really wonderful doctors, and I'm so grateful. But, you know, it just wasn't, I'm so glad I didn't take that path. And I'm so, you know, Mallarmé was strong enough to be, quote unquote, weak. You know, it's definitely the case in life that we can get addicted to praise. And we want so much the praise of others that we don't allow ourselves to explore other avenues, right? So, when somebody like Zuigan is asking, he might be testing his students. So, you know, it's hard to know what he's up to, right? Is he really insecure and asking his students, or is he pretending to be insecure to lure his students into something, you know, which is something some Zen masters do. So we don't really know what his motives are, what game he's playing here. But, basically he seems to be saying, well, Mom, what do you think? You know? And he seems to be hungry for praise. And that is a danger, right? It takes strength to say, I'm going to you know, I'm going to step out of my job for the, you know, such and such a time, or, you know, I'm not going to do this weekend, I'm going to come to Sesshin. And, you know, there's no social approval for this, right? I remember when I was in graduate school, my dissertation director said, well, here's what I want you to do next week. And he was very authoritative person. You know, he was like, I was his slave and he was the master, right? And he was like, you're the student, I'm the great master, here's what you will do. You know, and usually I did it because actually I liked him. I actually learned a lot from him. So he said, and next week I want you to do this. And I said, oh, I'm not going to be here next week. And he said, what? What? And I said, yeah, I'm going to a Sesshin. And he said, Sesshin, what's that? You know, and I said, I should explain. He was a Marxist, you know, and had very negative views of religion in general. So anyway, I said, oh, Sesshin, it's a meditation retreat. You know, we go and we met. You know, I knew I was treading on thin ice, right? It's like, should I tell this guy? Should I just say, well, you know? So I said, no, I wanted to see what he'd do, you know? So I said, yeah, you know, we meditate, you know, 8 hours a day for, you know, I think it was a 6-day Sesshin. And he was like, oh, he was really, it was like sputtering and muttering, like, what, you know, what? What a waste of your talents, you know? You should be writing your dissertation, you know? Don't waste your time. This is the opiate of the masses, and so on. So anyway, you know, he actually said, you know, you're wasting your time, you know, there was another guy, he's like the president of the organization that I belong to. His name is Charles Bazerman. And he's written a lot of books. He's a really smart guy. He's a very nice man. And, about 20 years ago, I was stable in my job. I got tenure, which is really wonderful. And I began to do sesshins all the time. You know, we were, for about 10 years, we were, actually more than that, for something like 15 years, we were doing 5 sesshin a year. And I stopped, because I was so busy with Sesshin, I wasn't professionally active anymore, so I wasn't giving papers and things. You know, it got around in my field that I was sort of like out of commission, it got around that I was doing all this Zen stuff. And somebody told me, Charles Bazerman, just his jaw dropped, and he said, what? He said, the next thing I know, you'll be telling me that Kurt has quit his job to go in, to join the circus. Yeah, I decided to be a lion tamer. Really, that's what he said. He's actually, I know, here he's joined the circus, right? You know, he had just total contempt, like as he lost his mind, you know. So I'm so glad I didn't listen to my graduate director. And I'm so glad I didn't listen to Charles Bazerman, who I really like, who's a really nice guy. You know, but I, you know, fortunately I was strong enough not to listen to these people. And I don't think it was a personal strength. I just, you know, when I started doing, when I started reading poetry, I just had to read poetry. I just, and fiction, it was like, what is this stuff? This is so great. You know, my father was in the military. And you know, military bases are among the most boring places in the, even more boring than Williamsburg, you know. Williamsburg, military bases are almost like jails, if I may say so, you know. A naval base is like a jail, right? And in my opinion, my personal opinion. And, you know, for a little kid to grow up there, there's nothing to do, you know. And a lot of my friends got into drugs and got into trouble with the police, you know, had police records. You know, a lot of service brats turn out really, they have problems psychologically, you know. And anyway, for me, you know, reading was like, oh, this is wonderful. You know, reading about like Charles Dickens, you know, amazing, right? Life is like this, or, you know, other books, it just like being transported and realizing, you know, not everybody is like these soldiers, you know, or these sailors, you know, and there's other worlds out there besides the United States Navy. And that was so liberating to me, right? So I just had to do it. I had to do it. And Zen was like that, you know. When I started doing Zen, it was just the most... I've been doing this for 40 years, and I do it every day, and it's the most interesting thing in the world. And it's so liberating, you know. This morning, my legs were a little tired, they hurt, but after the sit, I just felt like every atom in my body had been massaged. And it's like, I'm so thankful I didn't listen to those people, you know. So it takes a lot of courage to come here and do this. And you don't get any social approval for this, right? It's not something people, Zen. Now that, you know, that's fascinating, right? You know, if you tell people I meditate 2 hours a day, they look at you like you need to go to a mental hospital, right? It's like, as I always say, if you said to them, you know, I watch 2 hours of TV a day, they'd say, well, so what? You know, everybody does that. But if you say, oh, I meditate 2 hours, it's like, whoa, there's something wrong with you, you know, something that's wrong, right? You know, So you'd have to be willing to be, you have to be willing, in my opinion, you know, I have missed many social events because of my Zen life, you know. If somebody's having a party and it's Wednesday night, I don't go to the party, I go to Zen. And I'm not saying everybody has to do this, but, you know, definitely, I followed this voice in myself. It's similar to the voice that told you to come here and do this. And I'm so glad you did. And Suigan is, you know, we all have a tendency to you know, want that approval. But it can be a trap. And it's a little more complicated, though, because, you know, we're Americans. We all believe in being your own person, right? Doing your own thing, you know. I am an individual. I am the captain of my ship and the master of my fate. You know, we all believe that. So, but this is actually not quite the Zen view. You know, it's not like, this is not saying be independent. You know, when I was in college, everybody used to have a t-shirt that said, question authority, right? Question authority. But they all had the same t-shirt. It's like, maybe you should question the t-shirt. So, basically, we were all conformists in our, in a certain way too, right? Don't be a conformist. Yeah. And we all had jeans and tie-dye t-shirts. You know. Actually, that's not quite it. You know, earlier in the session, I said, you know, actually, being true to yourself is complicated, right? Because, basically, we Zen people are true to some part of ourselves, but not the part that gets up in the morning and says, what will I have for breakfast, right? There's a part of us that says, you know, you get up in the morning, I get up in the morning, and I sit, and then after I sit, I come down into the kitchen and I say, well, what would Kurt like? You know, and there's almond milk, I could have almond milk, I have gluten-free waffles, I have, you know, I can have rice and chickpeas, I can have, you know, different treats, you know, that are vegetarian treats, you know. For breakfast, do I want tea or coffee today? You know, that's the self, that's a self, you know. But in Zen, we also know there's this deeper mind that we encounter when we get to Mushin. You know, when you sit down on the cushion you know, that self says, oh, my legs hurt, you know, this hurts, or I'm tired, stop, right? But we don't listen to that self. We keep sitting on the cushion and we practice the great way. We watch the breath until we enter that blankness. And that's the door to our big mind. That's the door to our big unconscious mind. And I said, you know, basically, if you live the Zen life, you're cultivating a relationship with the stranger inside of you. There's a stranger inside of you, an enlightened stranger who is trying to help you wake up day and night, even when you're asleep. This is your Buddha nature. And so, you know, we have to cultivate a relationship with our Buddha nature. The Buddha nature doesn't necessarily take orders from us. We have to be receptive to Buddha nature. So when we go into that deep mushin, into that deep blankness, it's like sitting at a door or stare. Yesterday, the koan said it was like staring into a well and seeing your face in the well, or maybe seeing just blankness, like staring into a well, the deep well of your mind. And you're staring at this blankness, waiting for something, for what the koans call subconscious stirrings. You know, your big mind is going to start sending you a message. And, you know, you'll begin to have a hunch, or you'll begin to feel a compulsion, or your mind will keep turning and turning back to something. And eventually you'll have this feeling of like conviction, like that's it. Sometimes, not always. Sometimes you come into the Dokusan room and you don't have that feeling, but you still have the right answer, you know, so to speak. So you know, it's a little more complicated than just doing your own thing, or you know, walking your own walk, right? You know, that's a very conventional view. We all crave the approval of others, and that's a trap. It's also a trap just to imagine that we can be free without doing some hard work. Because, you know, basically, we don't always know what we want, and it's very hard for us sometimes to be honest about who we are or what we want. And, you know, if you sit in front of the big mind, in front of that blank space, and you wait, you begin to discover, you know, there's a deep part of yourself that wants to help you wake up, that wants to speak. And you have to learn how to listen to that self, and you begin to have a relationship with your big mind. So, you know, I consider myself the servant of my big mind. And my big mind has told me to do things sometimes that I don't necessarily understand. But I sometimes do them, and I'm always glad after I do. Sort of thinking, okay, you know, let's see how this goes. But something inside me is saying, you must do this, right? You must do this. And you know, the first time I went to Sesshin, you know, there was something that drove me to do that. And, you know, my first Sesshin, I had so much pain in my legs. I couldn't believe, and, you know, I don't think I had gotten up that early in my life, right? You know, it's like, I don't think I've gotten up at 5 o'clock in my life. So, you know, I was exhausted, you know, basically, you know, the... my legs hurt, I could barely walk, it felt like. You know, and when it was all over, I sort of said to myself, well, I'll never do that again. You know, and I think I signed up for the next Sesshin. You know, I remember standing in front of my class. I was teaching freshman English, you know, which I've been doing forever. And I put something on the board and I turned around and my mind went totally blank. It was like, I have no idea what I'm supposed to do next. You know, have I had a stroke or what? You know, But it was none of the, you know, I was just went into deep machine. And I sort of mumbled something or, you know, tried to cover. I'm sure my students weren't even awake, you know, so they didn't notice. But, you know, I signed up for the next sesshin. Something about this was so liberating. Liberating. So this koan is about trusting your big mind. And you know, that goes for koan practice too, right? You know, you can't control it. You're sitting in front of that blankness waiting for something to happen. And, you know, your big mind has its own wisdom. It is wisdom, right? It's wisdom. And it has its own agenda. It has its own agendas, which aren't your agendas. It's looking after your... It's looking after you much better, probably, than you look after yourself. And so you just have to sit there and wait for something to happen. And trust the process. And if you say, oh my God, you know, this is my third sesshin and I haven't answered my koan yet. See, now you're falling back into that socially approved way of thinking. It's like your Zen has to be productive, right? I expect this many koans answered in this period of time. You know, there's a ledger sheet. On this side, sesshins. This side, koans answered, right? See, that's not the way. Right? That's not the way. There's a great koan, by the way. A monk, Joshu, when he was in, I mentioned him earlier, he was visiting all these temples in China. He met this monk. And this monk said to Joshu, he said, you know, I meditate, he said, I meditate, you know, like 15 hours a day. 15 hours a day. Every day. And Joshu said, why do you let the clock dictate your behavior? I think that's a great, you know, why are you counting the hours? You know, who cares about the hours, right? This guy said, oh no, 15, I'm getting up to 16 next week, you know. And Joshua said, you're not free, you're a slave, right? Think about it. You know, you're worried about how many hours, you're tallying the hours. You know, Joshua is so cool. He's just cool. I love Joshu. Jiaozhou. So anyway, he says, you know, and that when I read that koan, I just burst out laughing because I was thinking the same thing. 15 hours, that's a lot of sitting. And then Joshu said, screw that. You know, what's your problem? Why are you counting the hours? You know, live in time, the timeless, you know. And if you think, I've got to answer my koan, it's my third sesshin and I haven't answered my koan, you're dragging yourself back into the world of seeking approval. You know, there were actually, I've had students, they're not my students anymore, but formerly students who would get upset if they didn't answer. It was like, I felt a lot of pressure as the session was coming to an end. Like accepting their lousy answers, right? Because it's like, if I don't accept their answer, they'll leave, you know? And eventually they did, as a matter of fact. You call yourself a Zen master. And it's just like being a teacher. You have to be willing. Let them, okay, fine. You know, I'm a big phony. You're right. Goodbye. You know? You know, basically, they were putting so much pressure on themselves to answer a koan a sesshin, right? It's like, I put good money on this thing. I expect some. It's like, my students are like that, too. You know, I expected an A, you know. It's, well, I'm sorry, man. You know, I'm not flippant like that. I said, well, you know, everybody wants to get an A, you know. And it's like, well, I'm a taxpayer, you know. It's like, okay. Or they come to see me at the beginning of class and say, I must get an A in this class. It's like, oh, okay. Let me write that down. But there's a little bit like that with these people who are no longer practicing with me, you know. They wanted results. And you know, that's the wrong spirit, you know. That's the wrong spirit. That's not in harmony with the way. So let's be in harmony with the way. So Suigan, at the end of the summer season, spoke to the assembly and he said, during the summer session, I have talked to you a great deal. Now look, has Suigan any eyebrows? Have my eyebrows fallen out? Hofuku said, the thief has a guilty conscience. Choke said, they have grown. Uman said, Khan. These are all enlightened people. They're not going to get caught in Suigan's little game with them. He's awakened, they're awakened. They're all friends, you know, it's like. But each person says something that comes out of his big mind. Each person says something that comes out of the deepest part of himself. And that's why their answers are all different. Suigan's words, unanswerable in thousands of years. Umon's Khan, losing his money, committing a crime, dotard Hofuku. Was he nimble or did he mumble? Long-tongued Suigan, definitely a thief. Flawless is the jewel. Who can appraise the priceless? Priceless. See, society doesn't know. Society doesn't know anything. You know. Okay. Choke knew well. He said, they have grown.